Hey, good afternoon from Charlotte, and welcome to Premier's Advisor Live webcast titled Washington Update on Health Reform Implications for Hospitals and Health Systems. My name is Lauren Solson, and I'll be your host today. I have a few quick announcements before I turn this call over to Blair Childs, Premier Senior Vice President of Public Affairs. Following the presentation, the operator will instruct you how to ask questions, but you may also submit them during the presentation through the chat feature located on your screen. This webcast is being recorded and will be posted to the Advisor Live homepage at premierinc.com within 48 hours of the call. Look for a follow-up email shortly after the call today, and it will provide you with the specifics on how to access all the materials for today's presentation, and it will also include a link for a brief survey about our program. Your feedback is very important to us. I want to thank you in advance for your comments and recommendations. Now I'd like to introduce you to our speaker today, and that's Blair Childs. Blair, are you there?
I'm here, ready to go. Okay. Let me get started. I've got a whole lot to cover, so we're going to jump in and we're going to go really fast. And hopefully everybody's logged in and can follow along with the presentation that you've printed it out. So first slide. I think everybody knows who Premier is, but let me just make sure it's clear that as many members of Congress have said to me, that the more they learn about Premier, the more they realize that if we didn't exist, they'd have to invent us, because what we are doing is uniting hospitals to overcome the fragmentation in our healthcare system, and that we are really, a lot of what you'll hear me talking about on healthcare reform are the kinds of things that Premier does every day. And so members of Congress are and members of the administration are very excited about the kind of work that Premier is doing. And so for those of you who are our members, we thank you for your participation and involvement, because you're the ones who make this work. And the other thing I'd say is part of our alliance activities is we do work on policy issues. We have a very active policy shop, and where we develop policy recommendations, and then we work with members of Congress to put those into place, and we work through our members on in that whole process. So we have become very well recognized and regarded in Washington as a source of credible information and an organization that's really making a difference. So moving on then, what am I going to talk about today? I'm going to first go over just some of the Washington political dynamics and implications around healthcare reform. Of course, the goal is what you've probably heard the President say and many members of Congress, which is to achieve near universal. I don't think anybody thinks we're going to ever get full, kind of complete everybody covered, because there's undocumented aliens, there's people who choose not to buy coverage and so forth. But we'll get near universal coverage without increasing the deficit. And that last part of the line is very important, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. Then to get us there, what are the policy solutions and ideas that are being advanced? And then what does this all mean? What do those policy solutions mean from the vantage point of hospitals? And I'm going to really focus on specifically what it means for our members, hospitals and health systems. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think is going to ultimately happen, and then what the strategic implications are, and then briefly just go over what Premier works on. So I think, as I've already said, the most important goal for many members of Congress is to achieve universal coverage or near universal coverage. And you all are familiar with the number of the uninsured in this country. It is a significant challenge for hospitals, as well as for inefficiencies in our healthcare system, because obviously people who are uninsured don't get care in the most optimal way today. So this is a major objective of the healthcare reform, and I should add that from the standpoint of members of Congress, this is a political issue, in that these uninsured individuals are people who are voters. So they think of it that way, and it definitely motivates some members of Congress an awful lot, depending on how many uninsured they have that they represent. The other thing I want to say in terms of healthcare reform that is the other kind of critical driver in this is what I call Washington's hidden agenda. And what I mean by that is that the current rate of growth of healthcare, and this is measured in terms of our gross domestic product, so that's all of the value in our economy. If you look at the growth of Medicare, or not Medicare, but of healthcare within our gross domestic product, and the impact of federal programs on that, the growth, you can see it going up over time. Now, most parts of our economy and federal budget are constant. They don't increase at a higher rate, because if they increase faster than our economy, it becomes unsustainable. You can't continue to grow everything in the government because you can't raise taxes, because whenever it grows, you've got to raise revenues somehow to fund it. If you look at these lines here, you can see the rate of increase that is projected for our economy under the current growth rates of health care. The top line is our current rate of growth. That's what we're currently at. So that dashed line there, the big dashes, that's the way we're growing right today. And that's the way it's going to grow going forward. The smaller dashed line is the projection that I'm going to refer to. And if we continue to grow at the middle line, if we grow at that line, we will have to increase our tax rates by 2050 substantially. And that's what the right-hand little bar chart or, you know, graph refers to, where I say that the 10% bracket will have to go to 26%, the 25% bracket will have to go to 66%, and the 35% bracket has to go to 92% to fund just the health care portion of the federal budget. So as you can tell, there's no way we're going to be able to tax the top bracket in this country at 92%. So we cannot continue on the course that we're at. And that's why you've heard more talk about bending the curve, reducing costs, et cetera, in healthcare than you've ever heard before. And it probably is the most central feature of what's being discussed in the healthcare reform debate. I call it the hidden agenda because people don't always like to talk about it, because it's something that people are uncomfortable discussing in terms of the implications. But it is the reality. So whether it's discussed or not, it's what is going on through government action frequently, and I'll talk more about that. So next slide is, where's the money? How are we going to get this money? Here's the areas that members of Congress and the administration are looking at. First off is the huge geographic variation. And this is a quote from Peter Orszag, who's the director of the Office of Management and Budget. That is the budget office for the U.S. government. And as he says here, that reducing geographic variation could eliminate hundreds of billions of dollars in wasteful spending. So in other words, if we were to get all the country to be like the lower cost parts of the country, and those are the ones that are the lighter colors, if you get the darker colors to be like the lighter colors, we can substantially reduce healthcare spending. So you can see in the next slide, this actually breaks it down by states. So you can see who are the lower cost states and who are the higher cost states. So as it says at the bottom left, if Medicare spending would fall 29% if the spending in the medium and high spending regions were the same as that in the lower spending regions. So cha-ching, members of Congress, the administration, they're all thinking, how do we somehow reduce geographic variation in healthcare? Another area of opportunity is readmissions. And this is a quality issue, needless to say, but there have been articles written about the very large number of readmissions that occur within hospitals for the same patient coming back repeatedly for a medical condition that many believe should be not an acute care episode. It should be something that could be managed after the person leaves the hospital. So this is the challenge that we have in healthcare, where there isn't a good handoff in some cases. And so people are looking at, how do we reduce quote-unquote preventable readmissions? And this is another area of major focus in healthcare. The next one is and you'll hear this being said by members of Congress and the President frequently, which is that our current system pays for value. It does not pay for value. It pays for volume. And so what do you get in healthcare? You get more volume. And so there's a lot of talk about how do we better incentivize or use payment to reward not just the procedure, but the way the procedure is done. So in other words, reward the value of the care that's provided, the quality of the care that's provided. And this chart here just references the Premier HQID, Hospital Quality Incentive Demonstration Project, that we undertook with CMS, whereby a portion of whereby hospitals were rewarded based on their performance to quality measures and outcomes measures. And as you can see, the darker bars are the hospitals in HQID versus all the other hospitals in the country. And the hospitals in HQID have outperformed their cohort, the rest of the hospitals, and this is the impact of paying or rewarding hospitals on performance. So this is another area where the lawmakers see we've got to better align payment across the system. The next thing along the kind of the payment side is that we have a lot of payment silos. We've got doctors who are paid in one payment system. We have hospitals paid in another, post-acute care, long-term care. And the goal is to try to cut across these silos because the concern is, or I shouldn't say the concern, the issue is that in each payment silo, everyone is, or whoever's in that silo is seeking to maximize their return on investment, so to speak, or their maximize their return within their silo. And they don't necessarily think about how could we potentially do our silo less expensively if we coordinated with those outside of our silo. So the idea is to better work across the silos. And then the last one, which from a cost vantage point, where there's a lot of attention is on medical technology, new medical technology. We have more new medical technology, be they drugs, biologics, or devices in this country than virtually any other country on earth. And the point is every one of these new technologies a significant improvement, or are they far out on the curve here, where they cost a lot more, but they really don't bring much more effectiveness? So the goal is to try to get that curve and be on the steeper part of that curve, still have access to technology, but have better information by which to measure this, the effectiveness of that technology. Now, all of this is, again, I've sort of referenced this in terms of that earlier slide where I talked about the hidden agenda and the rising cost and the unsustainability of healthcare spending. But the thing that's kind of overriding a lot of the healthcare reform debate in this country that's going on right now is member of Congress's concern about the federal deficit. And I have this here about the deficit. As you can see in the chart on the left, it shows the size of the federal deficit here in the United States as a percent of a gross domestic product. And as you can see, it's higher than it's ever been in the history of the country, other than World War II. So that is a huge concern to lawmakers. And then you can see on that right-hand chart that the 10-year Treasury yield has been bouncing up recently, and you're also hearing about negotiations with China, who's concerned about us as a creditor, that if our deficit is that huge, can we really afford to continue on the path that we're on, and can we really afford to increase healthcare spending if we don't somehow offset it? So that's why, if you think back to that first slide, we want to achieve near universal coverage without increasing the size of the deficit. And this is just a chart that shows the current policies of this administration and the projection as to where the deficit will go versus, you know, what current law may be and so forth. So this whole deficit equation and the focus on reducing cost could not be higher. I think that message is coming through pretty clearly. Now, in Washington, this all comes down to scorable, that's one of those wonderful Washington, D.C. terms, scorable ways to bend the curve. So how do we bend that curve, which I showed you earlier, and how do we do it in a way that's scorable, meaning it is something that the government can actually put down as a certain reduction in cost? It can be scored. So here's a chart that looks at some of the ways that they've talked about, you know, spending $1 trillion, which is what's anticipated, somewhere in a $1 trillion neighborhood is what's going to be required to expand coverage to achieve near universal coverage. So we're looking at that level of spending, and these are sort of the buckets. So it's the employer mandate or individual mandate and the subsidies that go along with that or payments that come in from that that are required, but also there's a potential income source there. There's savings from cutting back on Medicare Advantage private Medicare plans. It's savings by cutting payment to post-acute care settings. It's other savings from Medicare and Medicaid. It's scorable savings from the deal that was done with the pharmaceutical industry, the deal with the hospital industry. And then there's other sources, which are really tax increases. The next chart is really looking at some specific, you know, kind of ways that are being discussed to achieve those levels of savings. So the pharmaceutical manufacturers I mentioned, the $80 billion deal, which really from the standpoint of scorable savings is $55 billion. That's how much the pharmaceutical industry is sort of anteed up in its deal. And you all know about the hospital industry deal, which is $155 billion, and right on through. And you can see the way that those different scorable savings, so again, measurable, they're a direct reduction in the formula or the projection for how they're going to pay for, let's say, the hospital update in the future, or it's a tax increase, or it's some other kind of a cut that can be scored by the Congressional Budget Office. Okay, so let's move on to the policies area. And these are sort of the policies that I think, well, they're certainly the policies that impact hospitals the most directly that are the key areas of reform that we will see come out of healthcare reform in some way, shape, or form. So I kind of put these into four buckets. First off is sort of belt tightening and various payment and delivery system reforms. The next one is about transparency of quality and cost information. Then a focus on evidence-based healthcare and then attacking fraud and abuse. So bucket number one is the belt tightening and the payment delivery system and system reforms. So let's start off with what's going on right now, which is the end of this week. Tomorrow, we're expecting to get the inpatient rule finalized. We're going to get the final inpatient rule. The proposed rule, as you may recall, actually calls for a 0.5% reduction in payments to hospitals. We'll see what comes out tomorrow, and I guess what the projection is. It's going to come out tomorrow. But whether it's actually a reduction or whether they give a modest update, my prediction is it's going to be a modest update, but it's still in all. It's not going to be very significant. And then you've got an estimated 6.6% in cuts that are estimated for 2011 and 2012. So bottom line is, folks, we probably won't be seeing much, if any, payment increase for hospitals over the next 3 or more years. And this is on top, we got to remember, too, that the hospital deal calls for a also a reduction in the update through what's called a productivity adjustment. So the hospitals are basically will have to take a reduction in update payments because of a factor that's being put in call to adjust for productivity, which is a reduction in cost from other kinds of care quality improvement, reductions in hospital-acquired infections and other kinds of improvements. So the bottom line is we're not going to see big payment updates, and it's very possible you're not going to see any more money than you have right now for your payments to your hospitals in the next 3, 4, potentially even 5 years. And even then, it could be even a net reduction. What's also not going away is you all know that there was a new policy that was put into place recently, which is for non-payment, or I should say reduced payment for the additional it's actually non-payment for the additional cost of any condition which was preventable and is acquired within the hospital. And you all know the list of those hospital-acquired conditions. In the inpatient rule, there are no more hospital-acquired conditions that have been added, but believe me, they're going to be in the future. So that's just something to get used to and to realize is going to come down the pike. Now, we're also going to see, as I said earlier, we're going to move from paying for just volume to paying for quality. So it's paying for value, not just volume, is one of the key things we're going to see in the future. And we're also going to see efforts to cut across the silos. So these are the payment reforms that are going to happen as a result of healthcare reform. One is going to be hospital value-based purchasing. I don't think there's much question that that's going to probably be in this legislation. There's also a lot of talk about bundled payment and then also reduced readmissions. And you remember me talking about readmissions, but something to penalize hospitals that have high readmissions. And then there's also the creation of accountable care organizations. And then there's also testing of things like medical homes and also expanded payment for primary care. There's also a lot of discussion about additional payment model innovation, so a lot of testing of new payment models in the future. So let me just go through these very quickly. First off is value-based purchasing. Basically, you're going to see it starting it off at probably 2% of the DRGs will be used to basically reward higher-performing hospitals and penalize lower-performing hospitals. So a portion of your payment, your DRG payment, will be used to incentivize or reward higher performers. And hospitals will be rewarded based on not only achieving a benchmark level of performance, but also whether they've improved a lot. So you can be rewarded in one of two ways. All of this is based very closely on the premier CMS demonstration project. Another thing that's being talked about, and I think will probably happen, it will not be as significant a cut as has been discussed, I don't think, in the end. We've been working a lot with members of Congress on this, but there will be something in the area of readmissions where they're going to start off in a few years, a couple of years, 2011, I'd say probably, perhaps even 2010, notifying hospitals of their readmission rates and where they stack up across the country. So there'll be dissemination of information, and then over the coming years, there will be some kind of reduction in payment, whether it's through value-based purchasing or through just penalties, if your hospital has a high level of readmission. And these will be risk-adjusted to the extent that they can readmissions. And again, we've been working a lot on this because it is an area of significant concern. Because needless to say, readmissions are a function of the care that's delivered in the community, not the care that's delivered in the hospital. So why hospitals are penalized is not entirely fair or right. So we're trying to work that through with members of Congress. But that's one area where we're going to see some kind of legislative reform. Then we're also talking about a lot of moving towards bundled payment. And that's basically, and this will probably be done through pilot programs, but which will mean that they will be tested for a period of time, and then probably with the ability of those programs, if they prove themselves to be effective, to immediately go into nationwide application. So this would be bundling between physicians and hospitals. So let's say it's a cardiovascular procedure. Then it's the care for a bigger episode, not just the acute care episode. So it's for the care within the hospital as well as the post-acute care by that physician. That's one kind of a bundling approach that would be looked at. Another one would be bundling between hospitals and post-acute care providers, as well as potentially physicians. So those are this whole idea of paying for a bigger episode, cutting across the silos. That's the idea behind bundled payment. And then there's a lot of talk about testing the medical home and potentially rolling out the medical home concept, which is you pay physicians, primary care physicians, a little bit more to better care for and manage the care of their patients with the expectation that that will help keep those patients out of the hospital. And the other one that I wanted to mention is accountable care organizations. And what I've got listed here is the description of that's in the Senate Finance white paper that was issued a few months ago that is a voluntary accountable care organization. These were the requirements that you'd have to meet to become eligible, and then basically the way it works is that these accountable care organizations are accountable for the care of patients in their community, at least 5,000 patients. And if the organization is successful in keeping those costs below what otherwise would have been the rate of increase in those costs or the actual cost that was anticipated or projected for that patient population, then any savings that are in it that are greater than 2% would be shared, and it's one of them with a cap, potential cap of not over 5 or 6%, but that there'd be shared savings between the government and the accountable care organization. So this is another payment concept, again, cutting across the payment silos, paying for value, not for volume, approach to care. Okay, second bucket is improving quality, safety, and efficiency in healthcare. Now, some of it, you could say, was addressed through that last payment system reform, but here's some other ideas that are out there, and it's really focused on transparency. So one of the big watchwords in Washington's debate right now on healthcare reform is transparency. And that's everything from the what's currently going on, and that those are the existing initiatives. So it's Hospital Compare, and it's also the new reporting requirements to IRS for Form 990 for nonprofit hospitals, where you have to report a lot more data, and there'll be a lot more scrutiny on everything from community benefit to payroll and the way executives are paid. That's one area of transparency, but then there's additional transparency that's being discussed. So it's sunshine on industry payments to physicians. It's public reporting of hospital-acquired infections and other kinds of outcomes. I think there's going to be some kind of movement towards reporting on cost, so the cost of your procedures, what it costs to care for patients in hospitals, and also eliminating physician-owned specialty hospitals. That's a way that is, I think, a form of transparency. And then there's also new disclosure requirements for both hospitals and physician, for hospitals with physician ownership or investment. So these are all sort of new transparency initiatives. The next slide just talks about, you know, obviously the most recently rolled out new transparency measure, which is on readmissions. And this was rolled out a couple, 3 weeks ago. Beginning of July. And this, again, it doesn't take a rocket scientist at this point to see the writing that is on the wall regarding readmissions and the focus on reducing readmissions. That's real money to the government. They've got to somehow recapture that, and it's also real improvements in quality is the thought process here. So they've got this now in terms of transparency. There'll be, again, I think the movement toward paying based on preventing those readmissions. There's also now reporting on risk-adjusted mortality for AMI, heart failure, and pneumonia. And then I mentioned this, the whole 990 for IRS and the new requirements that are that hospitals will need to report. There's a special section just for hospitals, Schedule H. And then what I think is going to happen is you will see Physician Payment Sunshine Act, and this is a requirement on suppliers, manufacturers who make payments of value to physicians to report those payments. So whether it's a threshold of any payment over $100 or whether it's over $50 or maybe it'll end up being $150 or $200, there'll be a threshold over which every payment that is made to a physician by a manufacturer will be reported by those manufacturers and put on a public website so people can see those payments. This is focused on conflicts of interest that these payments can create with physicians, but it's also just so that patients are better informed about what where physicians may be receiving money and what might be influencing their decision making. The next bullet or bucket is focused on another one of these sort of quality points, which is the focus on evidence-based healthcare. This is a huge area and obviously fits in with the transparency issue because you need to have the evidence measures, and then once you have those, you can measure them, and then you can report them. So the kinds of reforms that we're talking about is comparative effectiveness research, and that's creation of a new entity that will conduct comparative effectiveness research. So requirement by Medicaid to follow all of the hospital-acquired condition policies. So those are the non-payments for those hospital-acquired conditions I mentioned earlier. there'll be national priorities and listing of those national priorities and some kind of a report card for the country on various quality improvement goals. There's new quality measures that the government will pay to have developed more rapidly. And then there's also this idea of creation of a patient safety research center to also undertake more evaluation, identifying, evaluating, disseminating information on best practices across healthcare. On comparative effectiveness, just so everybody, I think everyone knows what this is now. It's received a lot of attention, but essentially this is an entity that does research looking at the comparative effectiveness of drugs, devices, procedures, biologics to see if a patient has whatever the condition may be, diabetes, what is the best way to care for that patient given its particular condition related to diabetes. So it's meant to give an evidence base so that you can make better determinations as to what should be bought. And obviously, if there's a new technology, the goal is to make sure that new technology, remember that technology curve I had earlier, that we're not getting technologies that are way out to the right on that curve. I think where we're likely to end up is something which is an independent entity, not a new government agency, but that it'll be both a public-private entity. It'll be a publicly chartered private organization that will conduct this comparative effectiveness research. This is just a schematic that gives you a sense of sort of what are they looking at in terms of the kinds of the approach to comparative effectiveness, the type of information that they're hoping to get from this research. And then a recent report that came out, these identified these following conditions as areas where we really needed to focus the comparative effectiveness research. And so the last bucket I want to talk about is attacking fraud and abuse. There's already been a lot going on in this area. Just to review, there's already recovery audit contractors that are rolling out right now, as I think everybody on this call knows. There's also the Medicaid integrity contractors, which are doing the same kind of thing in the Medicaid program. They just created a new interagency task force on fraud and abuse, which is focused on rooting out fraud and abuse in healthcare. And it's a high level, the Secretary of HHS, Secretary of DOD, and a variety of different departments and agencies in the government that meet regularly to talk about how do we attack fraud and abuse in healthcare. And so all of these programs are moving forward, and there's even more in the legislation. I have here a map on the rollout of the recovery audit contractors, which is going on right now, and we're going to see the last rollout starting on the 1st of August. So there's going to be increased appropriations to fight fraud and abuse, so more investigators and auditors will be in the market or will be out there. There's going to be, again, more penalties and higher levels of risk for providers because of this focus on making sure that we eliminate fraud and abuse. So enhanced penalties for false statements, reduction of the maximum period for submission for the Medicare claims to reduce gaming, and that's something that's being proposed. And I've already talked about the hospital-acquired conditions, but they're talking about actually reducing, if a state doesn't implement and aggressively pursue non-payment for hospital-acquired conditions in Medicaid, then there will be a prohibition of the federal matching dollars. So this is the hammer side to that, what I talked about earlier. So this is just a picture of all these federal agencies you should get to know and love because they're going to become much more prominent in a new health reform environment after health care reform is passed, which I do think is going to still happen. And I know there's been a lot in the press about this, but let's move to that. So where are we headed? There's sort of three things that could occur. We could get comprehensive reform. Or if we don't get full comprehensive reform, when I say comprehensive reform, I mean expanding coverage as well as all these other payment, delivery system reforms, and a variety of other reforms, but it's really what President Obama has been talking about. If that doesn't happen, I think, and we don't expand coverage broadly, I think it's very likely you will still see significant Medicare reforms. So that's, I think, another, if you don't get the broad package, then another option could be just the Medicare reforms. And the last option is that this whole thing just blows up. And as occurred back in 93, 94, that's still a possibility. And I think if you've been following the debate in Washington, it's been pretty intense recently and a lot of back and forth. And who can say where this may all go? It's possible this will all fall apart. So just a couple of big things to be aware of. These are sort of the big factors in the health reform debate that I think are critical to whether this where this all goes, which of those three scenarios ends up occurring. First off, the Senate Finance Committee bill, which is Senator Baucus, Senator Grassley, and those are the chair and the ranking member, the Democrat and the Republican on that committee, that is where this bill will largely be worked out. If it's going to happen, it's going to happen more in the Senate Finance Committee, because the Senate is the hardest branch of Congress to get something through, and the Senate Finance Committee is taking a bipartisan approach, and I think it's going to require bipartisanship to really get meaningful reform done. So that's why, even though the Democrats have 60 votes now, with Senator Franken, who was just seated from Minnesota recently, even though the Democrats have 60 votes, which allows them to vote for cloture, and cloture is what cuts off debate in the Senate, so you can't have a filibuster. Even though they've now got 60 votes, as I think everyone knows, Senator Kennedy is absent at the moment. Senator Byrd is out much of the time, so they're down potentially two votes fair bit of the time, if not all the time, and we'll have to see how those senators' health continue. But there's, on top of that, there's some conservative Democrats who aren't going to just follow leadership and say, we're going to vote for this bill no matter what, and invoke cloture with their 60 votes. So there's no certainty that, you know, even though the Democrats have 60 votes in the Senate, that they can get this through. The House is another matter. The House is much easier to control for a variety of reasons. And the Democrats have a fairly substantial majority there. So I think the Democrats could get something through the House more easily. The question is whether it goes through the Senate. And that's why the Senate Finance Committee's bipartisan bill is going to be particularly important. Two groups, you've probably heard a lot recently about the Blue Dogs in the House, who are the conservative Democrats who've been making a lot of noise lately about the kinds of reforms they want, and they've made a lot of headway. They literally stopped cold Congresswoman Speaker Pelosi and the leadership from moving forward with a health reform package. So the Blue Dogs are a significant bloc. There's also in the Senate the G6 or the Gang of Six or the Group of Six, whatever. There's six lawmakers, three Republicans, three Democrats. Democrats are Senator Baucus, Senator Conrad, and Senator Bingaman. That's Baucus from Montana, Conrad from North Dakota, and Bingaman from New Mexico. And then Senators Grassley from Iowa, Snow from Maine, and Enzi from Wyoming, who are working together, literally meeting hours every day on this, trying to work out an agreement. And they are really at the forefront of trying to hammer out some kind of a final proposal. So what could potentially do all this in? Well, if they run out of time, they really need to get this done before the end of the year. And I think that is the hard deadline. So a lot of talk about deadlines. The one that really is going to matter is the end of the year, because if they go into next year in an election year, it's going to be really tough to get this done. Secondly is the thing I talked about with the deficit, and then third is the economy. The economy is at least stabilized now. The question is whether it starts improving. It's very hard to do significant reform in a tough economy like we've had. And then finally, the real decisions markup, which is where the House and the Senate reconcile their legislation. That's where the final cut gets made, and that's really going to be the place to be in terms of any final. You want to be in the bill if you're going to be in the bill going into markup, or you want to get in markup. So I've kind of talked about the process here, but the bottom line is this is going to get done in late November, December, more likely in December, and it's probably going to be close to Christmas by the time this gets done, is my expectation. So predictions. First off, this is going to get implemented over time and to leave future flexibility. So there'll be a timeline for when things kind of kick in over the next decade. I think the final package will probably, I still think they're going to end up with a comprehensive bill. So that was that scenario number one that I had. I think it'll be around a $900 billion mark, somewhere in that vicinity. A lot of the talk has been a trillion or a little over. I think it's going to end up $900 billion or perhaps a little bit less. Probably more likely to go down than up. I've already talked about the payment reforms. I think these are going to happen. We're going to have VBP. It's going to start off with hospitals, but it's going to go into all the other care settings over time. We're going to see voluntary ACOs. I already talked about that, readmissions, and then pilots of different kind of models such as bundled payment. There's going to be a focus on fixing the physician fee schedule. I don't think it'll be a comprehensive fix. There'll be some incremental fixes, but one of the significant things is there'll be an increased movement of money toward paying primary care physicians and away from paying specialists. And the reason why there's a focus on that is that the view has been that if you have more primary care physicians, you better manage the population and reduce people going to the hospital and better manage the overall care of patients, which reduces costs overall. We'll see significant insurance market reforms. This will be a nationalization of insurance regulation. Currently, it's managed at the state level. So there'll be federal insurance market reforms. There'll be some kind of a connector through which people can buy health insurance if they don't get it through their employer. I think we're likely to see an individual mandate. I don't think in the end there will be a real employer mandate, but there will be some kind of a penalty for employers who don't provide coverage. There's a number of other reforms such as follow-on biologics. Those are basically generic biologics that are available. Right now, there's only brand-named biologics because you can't have FDA approval of a follow-on product. So there's a number of other sort of drug and other Medicare cuts and changes that will occur. There'll be provider cuts for all sorts of providers. So whether it's durable medical equipment, home health, rehabilitative facilities or the long-term care hospitals, there's going to be payment cuts to those in the future years. I already talked about comparative effectiveness. I think we'll see some kind of tax increases. A lot of talk about taxing higher incomes. There's also some discussion about additional taxes on alcohol, soft drinks, high-cost health care plans, potentially. There's even been talk about taxing cosmetic surgery. So a lot of different taxes are in the offing and are likely to happen. And then the last point is transparency, and I talked about all of this. So what does this mean for hospitals? First off, everybody's already working on this. It's already clear. We know it because this is what we do the most of with our members, is working to reduce and costs or manage costs more effectively. But this is not. This has been important in the past. It's going to be imperative for the future. So this means everything from obviously everyone knows about the substantial bonus payments that are being made to hospitals for implementing information technology. It's going to be using information technology to better manage costs, better manage the population, and reduce costs. And it's going to be managing your supply chain and other kinds of things to reduce costs. it's going to be imperative is you could think about what I was talking about on the payment reforms. A lot of those payment reforms, particularly those that cut across the silos, means that hospitals need to much better integrate with physicians. So if your hospital isn't moving in that direction, it needs to be executing strategies to better integrate with the physician population. I don't think there's any question that hospitals are already active at the federal level. They're going to need to continue to be active, certainly this year, but I think for the foreseeable future. We've talked a lot about payment reform. That is just there's all kinds of strategic implications there in terms of what you're going to have to do from a quality and results standpoint. If you're not currently taking every step to get information out about your quality, about the way your hospital performs, and all those different metrics, you need to do that. It will be critical that there's transparency is a requirement of the future, and it will continue to be even more so. And I think another strategic implication is for our members that leverage Premier the best, they tend to improve quality and they tend to reduce costs the most effectively. So I think leveraging a Premier is one asset that is a critical value for the future. I talked a little bit about what we do here from a policy vantage point. We're very focused on impacting the payment reforms. We're focused on getting FDA to put out a unique device identification system so that we can track medical devices in the supply chain reliably. That's a priority for us to get that in place as quickly as possible. We're working a lot on helping our members with health information technology and receiving the stimulus funds there, but then also becoming meaningful users and effectively using HIT. Comparative effectiveness is something that's very important to Premier, and that's a lot of what we do, frankly. So that's an area of focus, is to not only get that evidence, but then get it back out to our hospitals and help our hospitals use it as effectively as possible. And then we're obviously working on the inpatient rule, which I mentioned earlier, and then we support the transparency of quality costs and conflict of interest legislation like the Physician Payment Sunshine Act. So that's a whole lot I just covered. I hope it all made sense, and let's turn it over for Q&A now. And I also want to mention that I'm not going through them, but there are a bunch of appendix. I put some additional slides here which talk a little bit more detail on some of the issues that I've mentioned, so readmission policy ideas, some of the key players in the health reform debate, Grassley and Baca Center, Kennedy Center, Enzi, people like that. So you can see who some of the players are. I have those in the slides that follow on. But Lauren, let me put it back to you or to Hamilton to open it up for questions.
All right, Blair, yeah, and these slides are available on the Advisor Live homepage already. I'll send out an email after this with a link to a survey, and that'll give you specific instructions on how you can download it. Hamilton, are you there? Can you quickly let our folks know how to ask questions?
I sure can. If you have a question at this time or a comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Once again, that's star 1 for any questions that you may have.
While the questions are queuing up, if there are any questions, I should just say, you know, I think one thing that people might be wondering about is, you know, there was a lot of focus on an August deadline for getting a package through both the House and the Senate. It's now very clear that we're not going to see a House vote, it doesn't appear to be anyway, on legislation, which was the most likely place. I don't think most of us in Washington here thought that we'd see a package voted on in the Senate, but it's now delayed. It means that when they come back, this will be one of the first things that Congress is going to take up to get this process moving forward. So I think there'll be a lot of work over the August recess, and I think one thing you can guarantee is that if you're in one of those key swing states, you're going to see a lot of advertising and a lot of political activity around health care reform in your state over August, I should say.
Hamilton, are there any questions?
Yes, we have a question from the line of Tom Neff.
Yes, how confident are you that physician-owned specialty hospitals are going to be limited in any kind of scenario with healthcare reform? You mentioned that everything could still crash and burn, but you're not confident of that. So given that there's Medicare reform and comprehensive reform, how confident are you that, that physician specialty hospitals will be included in that mix?
It's a great question. I would have said that, well, first off, point one is, as I said earlier, I still believe that you will see significant reform this year. So I don't think this is going to crash and burn. I think there's just too many stakeholders who have agreed that the time has come. So whether it's hospitals or whether it's even the insurance industry and the pharmaceutical industry, back in 93, 94, people were lining up against reform. This year, people are lining up in favor of reform. So it's a very big dynamic shift here. It's more a question of how this, what the house, how broad the reforms will be. So I think it will happen, and I think that the part of the hospital deal that was worked out, that $155 billion reduction over 10-year deal that I referenced earlier, one of the ingredients of that deal was ending new specialty, the creation of new specialty physician-owned specialty hospitals. So I would say that the odds are quite high that this will stay in, although I will tell you that there are some members of Congress who see this as one of those issues that they will fight to almost the bitter death over. So it's not over till it's over, but I'd say the odds are high that that will not, that there will be an end effective one, a certain date, that no new physician-owned specialty hospitals will be created. Does that help, Tom?
Yes.
Hope that answers your question.
Hamilton, is there anyone else on the line for questions?
None this time, but as a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1.
Larry, you have some closing comments just briefly while we see if there's any other questions?
Sure. I guess the other thing I had mentioned just from a process vantage point is you're sort of watching how this all evolves. There's kind of three steps in the process here that are going to be significant. First is sort of getting a bill through what's called markup, and that's when the committees go in, look at all the different provisions in the bills and make some decisions on it. And that's what's going on through all these discussions I've mentioned with the Senate Finance Committee and all the different committees in Congress. There's of the five congressional committees that that look at health reform, three of them have marked up legislation. One in the Senate, one in the House have still not completed markup. So that's one step in the process. And then you've got the process around basically the floor votes in each chamber and the amendments that occur around those votes. And then it goes into the final reconciliation between the House and the Senate packages. And that'll be the last real opportunity to impact what's going to emerge and then finally go to both the House and the Senate for passage. So there's three big steps in this process. One of them is going on right now and is going to be going on in early September, and then another one will be going on basically from sort of October, late September, October, November timeframe, and then the final debate on the floor will be, you know, sometime probably in December. Other questions? Don't be shy.
And we do have a question from the line of Clara Evans.
Hi, Clara. How are you?
Good.
Good. I had two questions. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about this pilot programs relating to bundled payments. How will they show that they're effective? Talk a little bit more about that.
Well, it'll be things like, let's say it's the episode that's being looked at is the acute care episode in 30 days post-acute care. And it's bundling all of the care between the physician, the hospital, and let's say the home health provider or, rehabilitative care center. So any providers that might be involved, there may be a bundle that would be sent And what's been talked about is that there'd be a payment that would be made to cover all of that that might be sent to the hospital or some, you know, intermediary who would manage that money. And they would say, okay, we've got an agreement that we're going to, you know, pay it out, but our goal is to coordinate the care and keep the costs as reasonable as we can. So how long do we really need to have the patient in the hospital, and then where can we shift them to that may be a high quality but less expensive care? So the community will then work out how that money gets apportioned for, let's say, a serious a chronic care patient with congestive heart failure, as a for instance. So that's the idea, is to take these major chronic conditions and try to say, okay, here is a pot of money that you would manage among all of these different providers, and you in the community will work out how you coordinate the payment among those providers. It's really complicated. It's going to be difficult. This is why it has to be tested. But we know right now with Premier that a number of our members have said to us, we would like to have the opportunity to test that idea. So that's the kind of a bundle payment approach I mentioned on bundling between the physician and the hospital. So you might take a cardiovascular procedure and you're going to say, we're going to bundle the payment for the physician and the hospital for, let's say, it's an implantable defibrillator, or let's say it's a hip and knee replacement. Then you say, we will say, this is the bundle, the amount of money we will pay for that, and you, hospital physician, need to coordinate and figure out how you make the payment for that particular episode of care, which is for the acute care portion plus 30 days post-acute for one of those procedures. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. That's especially difficult in California, as you know.
Yes. A good point. You've got states like California and Texas that have corporate practice of medicine laws, and it's the coordination and integration becomes very difficult. That's actually a good point and something we've been talking about on Capitol Hill, that you really should be able to override some of the corporate practice of medicine laws. That's a very tough political issue, though.
Yeah, needless to say. My other question, in the conversations this week with the Blue Dogs in the House, they talked a lot about the creation of this IMAC commission.
Oh, I
meant to
mention
that. I was wondering if you even wanted to touch that.
No, I did. I can't believe I went over that. Yeah, this is an idea, very important. Thank you for asking that. The IMAC is the Independent Medicare Advisory Commission idea, which Peter Orszag from the administration has proposed and sent a letter up to leadership on that. There's also a proposal that Senator Rockefeller's advanced that's been advanced also in the House called Super MedPAC. MedPAC is the Medicare Payment Advisory Committee. Commission. And it's an existing entity, and basically it's their creation of a commission or an organization that would provide, that would be an empowered body that would make recommendations to Congress. And the way, you know, like this IMAC idea has been advanced, or Senator Rockefeller's idea, is that they would present ideas that if the rate of increase in healthcare spending is not coming down at the rate that it needs to come down to meet the budget goals, then these recommendations would be implemented unless Congress votes it down within 30 days, something like that. I think in the end you're going to see something along those lines done. Now, this is very scary, frankly, because MedPAC has a history of making recommendations, which the historic process is they make recommendations. They recommend to CMS, for instance, on the inpatient rule. Just I talked about it that during my presentation. The inpatient rule that we're expecting out this Friday. That MedPAC makes recommendations to CMS on it. CMS says, yeah, we'll take this one, but not that one, or we'll modify this one. But they don't think MedPAC has all the answers right now. So there's concern about, one, the overall, is this really as the best decision-making process overall? Is it inclusive enough? Secondly, there is concern that when you have to cut spending, you go to where the dollars are, and the dollars are in the hospitals because the hospitals are the biggest chunk of the healthcare pie. And so it becomes an easy target, and there's some concern that it may not be a fair approach to reducing spending. So there's a lot of concern about it. My guess is in the end what we will see is something which is a little bit modified along those these lines. I think it will have some kind of a independent, more empowered independent body, but I think they will recommend, let's say, they'll be told to recommend, if spending doesn't come down by X amount, two or three options to Congress. Congress has to vote within a certain period of time, but they have potentially the ability to not accept any of the ideas. I think it's not going to be one of these, if you don't do it, it's going to happen. If you don't pass something, it's going to happen approaches. I think it'll be more proactive by Congress. But we'll have to see. But I think there's a substantial constituency saying we have to have some kind of a less political process to come up with ideas that Congress can deal with, that will bend the curve if we start, you know, if spending continues to go out of control. Sorry, long-winded answer. Hope that helped.
It did. Thank you.
Hamilton, anything else?
Yes, we do have a question from the line of Holly Sharp.
Hi, Holly.
We are very proud of our 28-bed.
Oh. Holly went and, you know, she wanted to give us music instead. I hope that wasn't a commentary. Hamilton, any other questions?
No questions at this time.
Blair, there's a question in the chat box. It says supplies and services that the hospitals purchase continue to increase and reimbursement continues to decrease. Are there any discussions in Congress to control these entities?
So these are, this would be like the, let me just see if I can, so we're talking about, can you read that again? I think it was referring to suppliers.
Yeah, supplies and services that the hospitals purchase continue to increase and reimbursement continues to decrease. Are there any discussions in Congress to control these entities?
Yeah. Some of you may have, gosh, that's not a good question. I should have mentioned this. One of the areas where there's a lot of discussion right now is, you know, there's been a deal with the pharmaceutical industry, a deal with the hospital industry. They're talking about a deal with the insurance industry, and then there's been negotiations with the device industry to try to get their contribution, so to speak, of scorable savings to reduce the increasing cost of healthcare. And this has been an area of intense interest and discussion in Washington. The challenge here is that there's been talk about a tax on medical device companies, like an excise tax on implantable devices. There's been other kinds of discussions about that. The problem is unlike drugs, which are paid for by government because of a formula, in the case of devices, the devices are paid for by the hospital. And the fear is that if you raise a tax on these products, you'll end up just increasing the cost of those products. They'll pass the additional tax on to the hospital. And even if you say something like, well, we're going to say you can't increase your costs to compensate for the tax, the fear is that it will just be passed on to the hospital. So it will be essentially a disguised additional contribution made not by the manufacturers but by the hospitals. And so this is a real tough nut to crack, to figure out how might those entities contribute. Now, I would just say there are a few things that I've already talked about that will make a difference. One is there is discussion about, as part of payment reform, allowing physicians to be rewarded for, you know, working to reduce costs and improve quality in a hospital. So that's shared savings among hospitals and physicians. If that were to happen, it would allow hospitals to better align with physicians in a way that could help manage costs for various products overall. That's one element that could be used in the future. Another thing that is in this and is actually being talked about in the legislative debate, another thing that I think will make a difference is comparative effectiveness research. That will bring a lot of evidence to what really is the best way to care for patients, and do we really need some new technologies, more expensive technologies? So there will be more focus and more information available there. Thirdly is the focus on, transparency of payments of value to physicians. And I think that will help reduce the conflicts of interest and the demand that some physicians drive to use certain products which hospitals end up having to pay for, which may not necessarily be the most efficacious or cost-effective. So those are areas that I think will impact costs. We are pushing very hard, I've already said this, unique device identification. That will reduce costs substantially by allowing greater streamlining and of the supply chain by using better electronic management of inventory. Right now, again, I think everybody knows this, you've got a barcode on every single thing sold in this country except for medical devices, where you do not have a unique device number. And that is outrageous in terms of patient safety because you can't conduct a recall as quickly as you can for dog food in this country. You can't do that with a medical device. But on top of that, it drives up costs. So that's an area that we think is critical to help reduce costs and also bring greater transparency in terms of what are the devices being used and how do we manage those going forward. The other thing that we're trying to do is say there shouldn't be gag clauses or confidentiality agreements for contracts that are negotiated by manufacturers with hospitals, which basically prevents hospitals from sharing the price points between hospitals for high-cost devices. So hospitals can't compare prices and find out what should they really have to pay for a device. So those are some examples of things that we've been talking to people about that we think are important ingredients to include in this debate to bring more transparency and to help, I think, ensure there's good evidence that will help address the cost of those devices, which are a huge cost to hospitals, the second most expensive embedded cost for hospitals. Hamilton, any other questions?
I'm showing no other questions at this time.
Blair, there's a couple more in the chat box.
Okay.
Another one is there any discussion concerning malpractice reform?
There's discussion. I don't think it's likely to happen. It's just a political reality that I think it's very, very difficult for there to be any curtailment of tort law when the trial lawyers are very influential in the Democratic Party, and I think that they're going to make it very difficult for anything to happen in that area. So I don't hold out a lot of hope. I have not seen anything included in the legislation anywhere thus far that is meaningful in this area. In fact, what we've actually seen is things that expand liability, not constrict liability.
Okay, there's one last question, and I'll put this out, and then we'll wrap up for today. Oh, actually, there's two. Do you think there will be a greater focus on preventative care to help reduce health care spending? What will happen to the facilities that are taking the failures at the acute care setting?
So the question is, was that on?
That's on focus the chat box.
Okay, I just found it, actually. Was this on preventative care?
Do you think there will be a greater
okay,
focus on preventative
right.
care?
Okay, I see it. Yep. There certainly is, and if you think about accountable care organizations, if you think about how those are structured, that is very much focused at primary care and prevention as opposed to acute care. So if you're accountable for the care of a population and you're incentivized to try to reduce the cost of the care of that population, then you're going to try to find ways to help that help keep that patient out of the more expensive settings of care. So I think we're going to see, and whether it's the increased use of evidence, increased use of things that will reduce obesity, I don't think we'll go as far as Japan, which have people that go out and actually, you know, mayors are incentivized to reduce obesity in their communities. I don't think we're going to go that far in this country, but I think there's going to be a lot more focus on things like obesity and other kinds of chronic conditions and how do we manage them. So whether it's bundled payment, accountable care organizations, which accountable care organizations are essentially bundled payment, if you think about it, or whether it's reducing readmissions, those are all about prevention, if you think about it. And it's those elements, plus I think, you know, other kinds of wellness initiatives that I suspect we're going to see in the future, be it through the insurance system where there'll be a higher copayment, or there could be rewards paid for individuals or some lower premium if you prove that you're not, you know, you don't have a chronic condition or you're not obese or something along those lines. So hopefully that has answered your question. I think there's a lot in those legislation that I've already discussed which will address prevention, will encourage prevention and reward prevention.
And I think if you're in the chat box, you'll see the last question of the day.
Primary care?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the question is, there's a focus on increasing primary care, but we already have a shortage of primary care physicians. What is the discussion at the national level to increase the scope of practice for nurses to fill this gap in primary care? Really good question. This is actually something that is in the outpatient rule that is under review right now from CMS. When I say these rules, I didn't really describe. These are the rules that CMS puts out that we provide comment on and other interested parties provide comment on. One of the things that they're trying to do is encourage more use of nurse practitioners and other non-physician care providers. I think the future of that is there's a lot of talk around that. It's, again, a very political, challenging issue, and that's one of the difficulties in healthcare reform overall. But I think the future is very definitely that we're going to find that there'll be greater liberalization, and of course there's everything from state licensure, and then the ability giving greater flexibility to the care that's provided by non-physician providers, as well as the issue of if you're not licensed in one given state, because as we're moving toward more telemedicine and so forth, how can you have providers from other state provide care via telemedicine or what have you for patients? So I think there's going to be more flexibility in the future without any question, because the point that's made in the question about the shortage of primary care physicians, I think one thing they're trying to do with the payment system is to reward more the primary care physicians, so more will move into that, but I think there'll be greater flexibility for nurses, et cetera, to care for patients.
Great. I think we'll wrap it up, an hour and 15 minutes. Thank you so much, Blair. I think it was really beneficial to a lot of us that are trying to get our arms around it.
You bet.
All right. That brings us to the end of the presentation. Everybody check your email tomorrow. I'll give you specific instructions on how you can download a recording of this presentation. Thank you for participating, and have a great afternoon. Thank you.